And the court will proceed to the second case, Sampo Japan v. Nippon Cargo Airline. Mr. Carlson?
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Chris Carlson, and I represent the appellate Nippon Cargo Airlines. It's our position that in this case, the district court properly found on the issue of the set-off that Nippon Cargo Airlines was entitled to a set-off, but incorrectly held that the set-off was applied to the amount of the claim damages as opposed to the amount of the judgment that actually was awarded against Nippon after trial. Now, there are a number of key undisputed facts which establish that Nippon is entitled to the set-off both under the Joint Tortfeasor Act and also under the common law and under the constitutional right to a remedy.
But how do we get to those, given the Warsaw Convention? I mean, it seems to me that it's a very odd reading of damages to say that it's not the amount that a jury finds or not these lower amounts. You want us to kind of look back and look at the invoice, essentially.
Well, Your Honor, you're right. We do have a very odd situation here. I think one thing we need to keep in mind is that the situation with the limited liability was created by the plaintiff in the way they chose to try this case. They sued all three defendants and alleged both contract and tort claims against all three of them. Although plaintiff disputes that now, it's in the complaint and in the amended complaint. There are negligence claims against all three defendants. The plaintiff went ahead and settled with Pace, which did not have any limitation of liability. It could have recovered the full amount had they proven their claims against them.
Well, that would have been the Carmack
case
if the facts had borne it out, of course.
Correct. But they chose to settle with the one defendant who could have paid them everything, and then in knowing that, they would be left with a claim only against Nippon Cargo Airlines, whose liability was limited. So they put themselves in this situation.
But why does that, in the end, why does that matter? It seems to me the Warsaw Convention has a limitation of liability. They point out if you want to avoid that, you can buy insurance, you can do other things that will create a different source of full recovery for you. That, for whatever reason, didn't happen here. This certainly was an international shipment. Nobody was under any misapprehension about that. I'm just having a hard time figuring out how you can pull this number out of the air. You know, what source of law allows you to look at a number like this that no court's ever given you?
I'm not sure which number you're talking
about.
The
invoice, the full invoice amount.
It's our position that that number is irrelevant in this case. The legally, judicially determined recoverable amount of damages in this case is the $74,000-some-odd that are recoverable under the Warsaw Convention.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only number that matters here. And under the Joint Tortfeasor Act, the language specifically states that the recovery on any claim against Nippon Cargo Airlines, the recovery has to be the judgment, shall be reduced by what the settling tortfeasor paid. There are dozens of cases I've cited in my brief that says you can set off the amount of the settlement against the judgment even if it results in that judgment being reduced to zero, which is what should have happened in this case. We had, I think it's important, Your Honor, as I set out in the brief, the undisputed facts here, there's no question there are tort negligence claims against all three defendants at the time of the injury. And it's important that the Illinois courts say that you don't look to the cause of action or the theory of liability under which the plaintiff ultimately recovered. You look at what happened at the time of the injury. At the time that these goods were damaged, all three defendants potentially were liable in tort. And that's, again, what the Illinois courts say. It's not liability in tort, it's potential liability. And that's especially true here because we had two droppings
Maybe, yeah, right. Yeah. The pallet fell, or I guess twice, maybe.
Exactly. What we could have had, the plaintiff could have, and it's not only the plaintiff, there does not have to be actual, you don't have to be shown to be an actual tortfeasor. It's just potential. You don't have to be joint tortfeasors. It can be joint, concurrent, or successive. You don't even actually have to be proven to be a tortfeasor, which obviously doesn't happen when you're let out of the case in settlement. But the what we have undisputed in this case is that the plaintiff made negligence claims against all three. The negligence claims against Nippon Cargo Airlines was that it negligently loaded the cargo into the truck. The negligence claims against Pace were that it negligently supervised that loading, negligently failed to secure the cargo before they took off, and negligently operated the truck. I'll leave Usen out of this because all we really need to do is deal with Pace. In the pretrial order, which is found on the Record on Appeal at 109 on page 6 of 36, the plaintiff stipulated, and we went into trial, that they were claiming, A, that the cargo was damaged when it was dropped. I'm sorry.
It was well, they claimed that it was damaged.
Right, when it fell out of the truck.
I want to kind of jump ahead here because it seems to me your position has to be once they've settled with anybody who might be in the Warsaw Convention chain for more than the $74,000 in change, they were simply taking a torch to their money to continue litigating because anything they recovered would have been set off and there would have been a zero number, so they just paid their lawyers for nothing.
Exactly, and that's why we made, as soon as the settlement was made, before trial, we made a motion for summary judgment asking the judge to set off the settlement, and we said a trial will be a waste of time. Well, mm-hmm. She denied that, and we also made it again after the trial. But let's suppose, Your Honor, the
But the 275,614 number was an undisputed number in terms of the bill of lading sort of invoice value of the shipment.
That's correct, but it had nothing to do with the case that was tried. What we have to look at under the Illinois law is the potential liability in tort at the time of the damage. Now, at that point, plaintiff could have, for example, refused to settle with Pace and went to trial against Pace and Nippon. There could have been a finding that, and as you'll remember in the papers, the point of delivery is important in this case, whether the Warsaw Convention controls or the Carmack, because at the point of delivery before and after.
Was it still in the international stage, yeah.
Exactly. If there could have been a finding, potentially based on these facts, that Pace was negligent in handling the goods while it was still in the custody of Nippon. They were helping them load it on the truck, and, for example, they didn't put the door locks up. Then the papers are signed and delivery is complete to Pace, and they drive away. There also could have been a finding that they were negligent. They would have been liable on the Carmack. Then it falls out. It's Warsaw Convention liability is finished.
It's over.
Then Nippon goes out there and drops it off the forklift.
I have a question for you, though. I mean, I can see that there are various fact findings that would have resulted in different allocations of liability under different laws. The Warsaw Convention itself has an article, Article 30A, that says, nothing in this convention shall prejudice the question whether a person liable for damage in accordance with its provisions has a right of recourse against any other person.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would, our position is, contrary to what the court found below, the fact that the Warsaw Convention ultimately applied to Nippon's liability does not in any way preempt the application of the Joint Tortfeasor Act. Because of that article specifically,
because of Article 38.
In addition to Article 24, paren 2, that provides that any action brought under this convention, however founded, whether in tort or contract, shall be brought subject to the conditions and limitation of liability of this convention. And then we drop down to Article 30A, which you pointed out, says it doesn't prejudice your right of recourse against someone else. So it doesn't preempt the application of the Joint Tortfeasor Act, and I would point out that that is exactly the argument that plaintiff made in supporting Pace's motion for a good faith finding on the settlement. Those motion papers are found on the record on appeal at 48, pages 6 and 7. That's exactly what they said. They said the Warsaw Convention does not preempt the application of the Joint Tortfeasor Act. Therefore, Your Honor, you should approve the settlement, and you should dismiss all the cross-claims against Pace.
Is it possible, logically, though, that there could be two tortfeasors? Because it seemed to me this was really an either-or. It was either under the custody of Nippon, basically, still, if the international transport hadn't ended, or it was the other. And it really, according to laws of physics, couldn't have been both.
Well, it can be, Your Honor, because let's take just a very simple example. We have, before delivery is completed to Pace, we've got Nippon Cargo Airlines. It's in their custody under the Warsaw Convention,
right.
So they are presumptively liable.
Right, that's when
we
Mr.
could
Thomas
also have, which we alleged in the case, that Pace, while it was in Nippon's custody, so before the Carmack Amendment attached, Pace committed negligence by, for example, failing to put the locks up on the floor. Then delivery goes over to Pace, and the Carmack is applicable, the papers are signed. They're driving away, liable under Carmack, it falls out. Nippon, now no longer liable under the Warsaw Convention, goes out and picks it up on a forklift and then drops it again. And by the way, in the joint pretrial statement, again, the plaintiff stipulated that there was one indivisible damage to the goods as a result of the two droppings. So getting back to
Nippon, in your hypothetical, has just gratuitously undertaken to pick it up with a forklift since their responsibility for the shipment is over.
Well, sure. I mean, it's sitting in their parking lot. They're driving away. Under this theory of potential liability, they're the only ones with a forklift. They go out to help. They have a duty to do it correctly. Now, under that, if they had not settled, they could have found, potentially, Nippon Cargo Airlines presumptively liable under the Warsaw Convention, Pace liable under common law negligence for its negligence before delivery took place, then Pace under Carmack, and Nippon Cargo Airlines under common law, and they could have recovered their full damages. They didn't want to do that. They put themselves in a situation where they got, by letting Pace out, they presumably made the decision strategically that they didn't think they could prove their case. If they'd never sued Pace and Pace was not liable, they would have gotten $74,000 from us. By bringing them in, filing a complaint, and squeezing them for a settlement, they recovered 46% more through those settlements than they ever would have gotten under the Warsaw Convention. So they put themselves in their own situation. I would just add briefly, we don't even need to get, I don't think, to the Joint Tortfeasor Act here, because assuming that the Warsaw Convention preempted the application of the Joint Tortfeasor Act, and assuming the Carmack Amendment preempted any claim against Pace, which I don't think it does, because it deals with plaintiffs' claims against Pace under their contract. We had no contract with Pace. Therefore, we had a common law cross-claim against them, and the joint tortfeasor aspect of the Contribution Act can be satisfied by a cross-claim. You don't need to be liable in tort directly to the plaintiff. You can be liable under a cross-claim or a third-party claim so long as it's for the same damage to the goods, indivisible damage, which we have here. And that's in the Doyle case, and it involved the third-party action. I lost my train of thought.
Did you want to reserve a moment for a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Ms. Espinosa?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Stephanie Espinosa, and I represent Sompo Japan Insurance, Inc. Your Honors, we view this case as NCA looking for a wholly inequitable result here. NCA was found to be liable for the damage to the cargo after a full trial, and it is not contesting its liability here on appeal. All it is doing is seeking to have its properly found liability reduced to zero based on kind of an extreme interpretation of the Contribution Act set-off provision.
But let me ask you the same question I was asking Mr. Carlson. I mean, you have the Warsaw Convention. In some ways, if, well, and under the Warsaw Convention, there can be a couple of different entities who might have been liable for a cargo loss like this. And yet the convention has this limit. It doesn't say per actor or anything. It doesn't say, you know, 17 special drawing rights times the weight per defendant. It's just a cap on liability. So if this had gone all the way through to a trial and somehow or another more than one entity had been found liable, the cap would have been 74 and change. What I just don't see in the convention is where it is you can say that even though they've now received much more than, you know, well, you've received much more than 74, the 108.5, why that isn't a set-off if this is a Warsaw Convention case and the remaining money goes down to zero.
Your Honor, we, with respect to the Warsaw Convention issue, we would direct the Court's attention to Article 25, which does discuss allocation amongst carriers and agents under the Warsaw Convention, which is, I think, what you were referring to. And I think our interpretation of that provision would be that an agent of a Warsaw carrier may be entitled to, I'm sorry, a carrier might be entitled to a set-off against any amounts that a Warsaw agent might provide. However, that this does not speak to non-Warsaw defendants, and we would submit that the Warsaw Convention, because it does not speak to a broader kind of allocation or explanation of what would happen in a situation like this, it only allows for set-off against Warsaw carriers and agents, that Nippon NCA would not be entitled to a set-off against amounts from Pace, which could not be a Warsaw carrier. And really, they're just two separate things. And I would say that NCA is kind of trying to muddy the waters a little bit and kind of combining these issues, but in reality, they're separate legal schemes.
Well, of course, there's no adjudication vis-a-vis Pace as to what theory it might have been liable under, whether it was liable under any theory. I mean, they've just settled to be finished with it. But you could, I don't know. I mean, the problem is, where do you find the right not to have a set-off once you've had potential contract liability under the convention?
I think, Your Honor, I don't think the Warsaw Convention speaks to this issue, and we would submit in the first instance that the Warsaw Convention would not allow a set-off. However, if you do go into the Contribution Act, or perhaps maybe just a common law understanding of a rule against double recovery, which is really kind of the equitable issue here. You don't want a party to receive more than what it's due. And the district court properly made a finding that resulted in the equitable and proper result here. The district court found on summary judgment that Sampo's total proven damages were at least the $271,304 amount. And she took the set off against that full amount. And she, of course, in the same instant, recognized that NCA's damages were far less than the $160,000 deficiency between the settlement amount with Pace and USENT and Sampo's actual proven damages. And so even if you accept and take a set-off here, it should be taken against the actual damages here, because the kind of set-off rule is really intended to not allow a double recovery. And there's no way here that Sampo was ever going to receive even one full recovery for their loss, let alone two.
But even under your theory, it must have been a mistake not to credit the $8,500 with USEN.
Your Honor, that is not an issue that NCA has raised.
I'm just saying the logic of your argument, it seems to rest heavily on the idea that Pace is utterly separate from the Warsaw Convention and the international transport, and you certainly can't say that about USEN.
Well, we would say that USEN was a you know, it was a co-defendant, another Warsaw carrier. So I think their liability would be separate from NCA's as well. And so
why? It's all one. They're all agents of one another.
Well, we haven't really. I don't know that it was ever really delved into the exact interplay between NCA and USEN, except to say that they were both named as carriers on the shipment papers on the
right. I
mean,
it's
just lading,
it's very
and whatnot.
Typical. It's a chain of freight forwarding parties and agents who eventually arrange for the shipment to the place. But I'm just trying to work through your logic on this, and I don't see where the 8,500 isn't squarely within the Warsaw Convention's limitations of liability.
Well, I mean, we would certainly concede that USEN's liability would have been limited as well. Whether that would come in within the same limitation, I think we, at this point, would dispute that. But certainly, they were a Warsaw carrier, and their liability would have been limited. Absolutely. Going back to, though, the arguments that were raised by NCA with respect to the Contribution Act, we would say that although, you know, the language of the Contribution Act does discuss subject to liability and tort, we are dealing here with two federal schemes of law, a federal treaty and the Carmack Amendment. These two provisions of law preempt almost really every, you know, every other cause of action that could be. So this case
except
is quite
that the Warsaw Convention itself says it's not preempting other sources of law that are compatible with it, that in a sense supplement.
Well, and I think that, you know, and I don't, I believe you're referring to Article 30A.
Yeah, I am.
I think that that may be referring to perhaps other remedies or results that might not be as specifically related to what we have here, which is a simple Warsaw Convention case. We have, you know, a shipment coming in from another country and being damaged while being unloaded. And it's a very straightforward case, and NCA was always going to be liable pursuant to the Warsaw Convention. And Pace, as recognized by the district court, was always going to be liable pursuant to Carmack. And the district court.
But your theory does seem to be, you say it was always going to be liable, but if there were, let's suppose this often happens, you know, there'll be, you know, an ocean carrier, maybe it's a combined bill of lading. So there's ocean carriage and maybe rail carriage or train or air carriage. Somehow, the I guess what I'm thinking is that there could be a couple of different actors who are both jointly providing the Warsaw Convention carriage, and you seem to think it's the 17 SDRs times the weight per agent, and I don't know that I thought the Warsaw Convention made it per shipment.
I would have to go back and review whatever specific provision would refer to that. At this point, though, we are...
because I would say, you know, if there had been a settlement with somebody else who was potentially liable under the Warsaw Convention, and that settlement had exceeded the 74,000 and some for this shipment, then there would be a right to a set-off. You can't get two Warsaw Convention recoveries or there wouldn't really be a limitation of liability.
Well, and I think that kind of that relates back to Article 25 again, which mm-hmm. talks about agents of. And I don't know here that we necessarily have the situation of an agent relationship between NCA and USEN, but I do recognize mm-hmm. recognize your point. But again, you know, we view this as creating the proper result here under either an interpretation of the Warsaw Convention or under the Contribution Act or, again, in under kind of just general rules of equity. The district court properly relied on the actual proven damages of Sampo in offering the set-off against that. And now what NCA is trying to do is kind of avoid its clear liability here and seek to reduce its liability to zero where that is not equitable. That is kind of a roundabout, trying to get around, you know, their stated and their found liability after they've already been entitled to a limitation of liability pursuant to the Warsaw Convention. And that's another, you know, a difference here with that obviously distinguishes this case from other cases in which we didn't have a limitation issue. NCA has already sought and accepted and been given the benefit of the limitation of the Warsaw Convention. And
but
now they're seeking something in addition to that.
And, but what the Warsaw, I mean, their response to you is just, look, you know the Warsaw Convention has limitations of liability. You can buy more insurance on things. You can, there are special procedures for that. And this is really all about who has the burden to take those steps.
I think in the realm of air carriage, typically those steps are not taken. This is, you know, a commercial issue, and
so there's a certain amount of assumption of risk, is what you're saying. I mean, maybe air carriage is very reliable, and that's a sensible thing to do.
I think when a problem does arise, Warsaw Convention provides a framework for liability for the air carrier, and Sampo, as the shipper, is entitled to those protections. And, that's mm-hmm. the way the scheme works. I don't know if your honors would like me to return to our cross appeal now, or Sampo is also seeking an award of prejudgment interest on its on the finding of liability against NCA. We would just submit that we recognize that the court, and I believe specifically Judge Flom, in the Deere & Co. Decision in 1988, did interpret the original Warsaw Convention as not allowing prejudgment interest, as prejudgment interest on an award of the situation being somewhat inconsistent with a kind of fixed and uniform damages cap under the convention. But we would submit that in the time since the Deere & Co. decision that other courts have kind of taken a look at this and recognize that allowing prejudgment interest is not inconsistent necessarily with the idea that liability under the Warsaw Convention should be fixed.
But, you know, it is inconsistent in some instances with the idea of a cap. And let's take two cases. One is yours, where your damages are high enough that you hit the cap and obviously exceed it, but you're at the cap. So whatever the time value of money may be, whatever other considerations are there, doesn't really matter because you're at the cap. Now, if you had a shipment that was instead, after all was said and done, only $50,000, and then you wanted some prejudgment interest so that you would really get the full value of your judgment, so it moved from $50,000 up to $58,000, and you're still under the cap, maybe that would be a vehicle where we might, I don't think that was before the court in Deere, and right. I don't know that we needed to think about that. But I think the fact of the cap, it just means whatever the time value of that money is, you've already hit the cap. So how can you go higher than the cap?
I think you need to look at prejudgment interest as really the actual value of what the plaintiff is out because of the liability caused or the damages caused by the Warsaw carrier.
But that's exactly what this is not about. This is about making sure that the liability doesn't go above a particular dollar figure. And so just because, you know, the judgment is issued one day versus another, it might affect the valuation of the currencies in the SDR basket, but it's not really going to affect the amount of the judgment.
But in fact, the Warsaw Convention, although its purpose is to limit damages and make them foreseeable and more uniform, the Warsaw Convention itself does recognize there are certain areas of damages that can be added, which would make the award
well, those are
less
costs
determinable.
And local rights to attorney's fees, which are different.
Correct.
Isn't it
time
strange
value
that,
of money. I'm sorry.
Isn't it strange that the Warsaw Convention hasn't addressed this issue? It's addressed other kinds of ancillary charges, hasn't addressed this one.
I don't know that I'd call it strange. I think it perhaps could be explained away by the fact that some jurisdictions do permit prejudgment interest, and perhaps it's something that they felt they perhaps didn't need to address.
What is the situation among other signatories? Do most continental systems give prejudgment interest as a matter of course?
I can't speak to all the jurisdictions. I know in
That's a big chunk of the signatory parties to the Warsaw Convention, is it not?
I'm sorry?
The civil law countries are indeed a large part of the signatories to the Warsaw Convention.
Yes, I believe so. And I believe in the Swiss Bank case, which is an English case, but which addressed this issue, I believe it did refer to the notion that there are a number of signatory nations that do allow prejudgment interest. And I apologize, I cannot, off the top of my head right now, tell you one way or the other whether they're civil law jurisdictions, but I believe that may be correct. But that case did address the idea that this is an issue that is not certainly not disposed of negatively by other nations.
Domestically, there are certain issues that where we defer to the legislature, and if the legislature hasn't decided to move in that direction, we infer that the legislature doesn't want us to do it as well. Shouldn't we have a similar deference to or maybe even more? The case of an international treaty? I mean, if the signatory parties want to address prejudgment interest, shouldn't we expect that they address prejudgment interest?
Again, Your Honor, I would say I think that it's perhaps one of these notions that when you're dealing with such a body of law that's been put forward by so many different nations, that I don't know that you can make that same assumption when you're dealing with an international treaty.
Isn't that what treaties are for? You know, when people in different legal systems do things different ways, but they've got to cooperate, you expect that a treaty is going to be negotiated and there's going to be a rule.
Right, and I would say that, you know, a treaty is not going to be able to address every single issue in the most clear way, and so I think perhaps this, you know, could be an issue that some parties perhaps didn't think needed to be addressed in an overt way in the treaty, but that they still implicitly recognized did allow it. I see that my time is up.
Just one question. So what is your position on the impact of the Montreal Convention, if anything?
Or
an interest question.
Okay, I just want to clarify. Are you speaking to the Montreal Protocol 4 or
no,
the current Montreal Convention?
The new one.
The new one,
okay.
In 03. Which speaks about, it has language including interest, but has no discussion of prejudgment interest.
Right. You know, again, we would say that it doesn't explain what it's speaking to. And so I think it could go either way, really. And I think that there's no indication that they were trying to clarify that there wasn't prejudgment interest allowed before, and now there is. I think that you cannot imply or...
You can't draw anything from it.
You can't really draw that conclusion. So we would say that really doesn't, unfortunately, doesn't flesh out this issue much more.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Carlson?
Yes, Your Honor. Just briefly, I'd just like to address two points. Just to point out that the argument, both here and in the brief, about Article 25 of the Montreal Protocol 4 somehow dealing with the issue of set-off, it doesn't deal with it at all. It's completely irrelevant. Article 25 was designed to prevent someone from doing an end run around the convention's limitation of liability by, for example, suing the pilot in his individual capacity and then claim that he's not a carrier, therefore he's not liable. So it's specific. It's done to prevent that from happening. It's got nothing to do with set-offs. Secondly, on the issue of or the argument of the equities of the situation, the statute says what it says, the Joint Tortfeasor Act, and it can't be read differently to address the equities in any given situation. But beyond that, I would submit that this is not a case where there is an inequity being visited upon the plaintiff here, because the plaintiff's trial strategy in this case, by settling with Pace, knowing they had unlimited liability, and trying the case only against us, they in effect created the situation where their damages were limited to $74,000. They established that the amount of their damages was $74,000. Legally recoverable damages in this lawsuit was $74,000, not the $278,000. They've got only themselves to blame. I see I'm out of time. Unless you would like me to address the prejudgment interest issue,
you may make a comment on that.
Well, Your Honor, I think that as I've set forth in the brief, the history of the various conventions and the amendments are pretty clear. This court said under the original convention in the Deere case that prejudgment interest is not recoverable, and interest clearly is an element of damages, which are capped. In 1929. 1955, when the Hague Protocol was adopted, it amended that provision of the convention to add for recovery of costs, litigation costs. That's not interest, prejudgment interest, and clearly the courts and the legislature were aware of prejudgment interest and the availability at that time. It's not until 70-some-odd years later, when we get Montreal Agreement, that the word interest comes in. So that by itself, the absence for those 70 years, I think indicates the intent that it not be in there. And just so there's not any, in case there's any confusion, Montreal Agreement of 1999 did not come into effect for the United States until November of 2003. So it's completely inapplicable to this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.